We have such a brief time today, and I'm just here just to sort of move into the sculptures. And on the screen behind me, we're going to roll through some drawings. These are earlier drawings that I did a few years ago in preparation for this whole concept of speaking out loud, visually saying he's no longer dead but alive. So those images are large drawings, about 4 foot. And it was him giving me these. I mean, you know, what did the land look like? What did the sky look like? What was that stone like? That moment, that instant when he's no longer dead but alive. What were the 3-day period or that just that very last day? What was it like? So I try to talk about that. And these are mostly just drawings, sort of describing. And, you know, we don't exactly know. But if you are quiet, and for me that's a huge challenge, if you're quiet and receive from him, he will tell you what it is he has for you to say, so that we are co-creators with him, so that I didn't have to just do clever things, well-crafted things, things that people would think isn't just good art, which is a worthy objective. But I wanted to be able to show visually things about the fact that he's no longer dead or alive. So we have about 8 more of those. And this next series, these are not drawings. These are actually clay relief sculptures that are a couple foot across. And I think for me, these are the most important things maybe that I have ever done up until this last series. So those are slab clay pieces. Also describing the empty tomb, which you can see there. Maybe the stone still in front of it. And then on this one, which, by the way, is sideways. Art people always get their slides in sideways. Showing power, somehow power moving down from above and moving that stone. And in the process, the creator of the universe, his son, becoming alive instead of dead. So just look at those and sort of sense, for as best you can, what you might say if you were describing that moment. Look at the sky, look at the land, see what it looks like, and sort of understand he was moving in those moments. And then the greatest part of that is the promise that we also rise from the dead and get to live with him eternally. So when you go to the library, and we're just mostly showing these, letting you see what led up to the piece that's in the library, and I think that eventually moves over to the Student Center. But when you go look at that, you spend time with things. Sit in front of it and allow it to speak to you. Allow God to speak through these images which he gave us. Allow them to speak to you. Last night when I was in here looking at Prof. Meller's painting, and you guys just keep rolling those. We have like 3 or 4 more. And these are all stone. First they were drawings, and then they were clay reliefs, and these are all stone pieces. Last night I was at the altar, and we registered students years ago. You would go to the cafeteria, and you would sit in front of us, and you would say, I would like to take painting, a drawing, or printmaking, or sculpture, or ceramics, or art history, or photography, or graphic design, whatever you wanted to take. And we would discuss that with you and help you get in that class. Today you just push a button. But I would always come over here to the altar, Hughes, and kneel and pray before I went to registration in the cafeteria, because you're ready to shape people's lives. You're determining what they're going to do the rest of their life, who they sit with, what they learn, who they're in. So I would always come over here and pray about God's will that I could help communicate to the students. And last night when I was at the altar praying in the dark, it's wonderful in here about 9, 10 o'clock at night, I was praying in front of this painting. And the one time that I remember clearly God speaking to me, I was kneeling here during that time just before registration. And I looked up and I was reading this, holding this under the Lord. And I remember saying, I love you, Father. And I clearly remember him saying, I love you too, son, and calling me son when he said that. Not audible, but I knew that that's the one time in life he spoke to me. Well, so last night I was kneeling here praying, and I felt something walk behind me. And I thought, you know, at first you think maybe this is an angel, maybe God is speaking to you again. And I realized it was one of the dudes in the media com with the flashlight getting everything hooked up. So it wasn't the wonderful experience that I had before. But great space. You have to come in and look. Well, I want to wrap this up and just say, encourage you to go to the library and spend time with it. Sit in front of it for a while and allow it to speak to you. Come to Prof. Miller's painting, sit with it and spend time with it and allow it to speak to you, because he is our co-creator. So we made these pieces through him and with him. And that's hope that you have a chance to go over there and not just look at it, glance at it. We all tend to do that because we're all so instant today. But allow yourself the joy of sitting quietly with the peace. I need to also just say that we have lots of guests here today, and Lexington Christian Academy brought 17 art majors or art students with my daughter Paige, who's an art faculty there. And so we want to make sure that they feel welcome this day also. And thankful for that huge group. Okay, I wanted to close down my part and introduce to you somebody that we are really fortunate to have here. I mean, the budget at our chapels is either non-existent or fairly small. So these people come here to share with you what he has put on their heart. And Catherine Kapikian is a working artist, not just somebody who has read about it or knows about it, but she's still making art. She's on the faculty at Wesley Theological Seminary, and she has just finished a book called Art in the Service of the Sacred. And maybe what we need to know about her is she is a pioneer in the whole concept of putting art and theology together, especially her task at the seminary is to integrate the art and theology. So I'd like you to welcome her as she comes and closes out the morning.
Good morning. It is a wonder to me that I find myself in this place at this moment, a revealing moment in an artful life. Such moments as this one are part of the apprenticeship necessary for the big art, which is my life. This is the first time, in spoken words, I will share my faith story. Unlike most of you, I now have the privilege of looking far back. Wonderment is the word for what I behold. An occasion in my 30s had me thinking about the parable of the mustard seed. I had challenged Wesley Seminary in Washington, D.C., with the improbable notion of appointing me as artist in residence. I had completed seminary education, but viewed it as truncated. I was seeking theological literacy as a working artist, looking to make connections, but the arts were rarely, if ever, mentioned during my study. At a gut level, I knew there were deep correspondences between art and religion, images and faith, applied creativity and spiritual formation. I did not know how to speak about such relationships, nor how to think about them systematically. Seminary education gave me little help. Thus, I graduated in 1979, unable to articulate connections. Yet I emerged with an intensely uncomfortable sense of a call upon my head to push this inquiry and to probe the institution from which I had graduated to address the absences. In addition, curriculum investigations at other seminaries further indicated a whole-scale absence of the arts. Odd, I thought. How could the arts, so vital to theological proclamation, be left out? Could it be that God's hand was upon me? You did not choose me, but I chose you. Before you were born, I knew you. Preposterous. Yet seminary had sustained my deep, abiding love affair with God. And my three little boys and husband at home were tolerating my foray onto new turf. Was I in the grip of God's transforming power? Poised on this particular pinnacle of discernment, what was required of me? I put my trust in that little parable of the mustard seed, found in three of the Synoptic Gospels. The kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in the field. It is the smallest of all seeds, but when it has grown, it is the greatest of shrubs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches. The fork in my road loomed large. At that time, my peer community of artists belittled, in fact, openly disdained artists who let religious impulses invade their works. One dared not be confessional. I was viewed as wrong-headed. Yet I knew that quality art in the context of liturgy brought people to their knees. I knew that the museum gallery scene had eclipsed the prophetic power of the temple. I knew that catalogs were providing guides to liturgies of adoration. In my judgment, some correction was necessary. Truthfully, it was intriguing to believe in that little parable and others like it, which stake a claim for the transformative power of Christian truth. After all, I was driven by a deep conviction of necessity, so strong that I needed to trust in it. Would stepping, step by step, one in front of another and another, into this new territory differ from the steps I learned to take as a child, when a set of new crayons, or later an X-Acto knife and a piece of balsa wood, were put before me? I didn't think so. Creative challenges bear likeness. Besides, as a little girl, I had stumbled upon the sheer joy which accompanies creative work. I learned that the product of such work interested me far less than the process which led to its completion. Thus, in my adult life, oriented as it has become, process rather than product has dominion over me. Perhaps that is why I don't own a single piece of my own work. Perhaps that is why the following statement recently encountered resonates with me. Christian witness, I read, is a manifestation of God's activity through the expenditure of a human life. The trick would be to quiet the inner voice of inadequacy and ignore institutional politics. O woman of little faith, now looking back, I realize that I was called to a special place for a special service. I remain rooted in the artist's way of working. This means I impose discipline upon myself, assess problems, acquire skills in an ongoing manner, and implement leaps born of the imagination. Dream huge and dream in technicolor. In the art of our becoming, our Christian heritage assures us that processes expended in daily attentiveness to its teachings will bear fruit beyond our imagining. Such discipleship promises a risk-taking adventure. And risk-taking it has been. It is risky business to sit on a theological faculty without a PhD. Yet the banter and parlance of the years have paid off. Wesley Seminary is a transformed place. So are the churches and other theological schools infected by our teachings. At Wesley, the thorough curricular-wide integration of the arts is as unselfconscious as breathing. From the humble beginnings of an experiment with a reluctantly appointed artist in residence, me, placed in a windowless basement, new alliances have been forged between art and theology, art and religion, art and faith. We have built a prototype model for theological education. 60 artists in residence over the last 25 years have each left a work which graces our institution with its presence. This art, by its very nature, is gratuitous. We don't know we need it until after it is created. Slide, please. Art bears within itself its own confirmation. I will also note that it is risky business to attack visually a 170-foot blank wall. But I remind my students that risk-taking is one of a handful of attributes necessary for creative work. Utilized in their aggregate, these attributes become the springboard for ushering in new meaning in our world. We are intended to be initiating centers of life, contributing to the work of transformation. As bearers of the divine image, you and I receive the gift of creative potential as part of our genetic endowment. We build our world with this human resource. And just like Jacob, we must wrestle with the angels. The trials and tribulations of my undertakings propel me through processes fraught with stark moments of panic. When I have passed to the other side of what sometimes feels like a gaping abyss, I am aware once again of a gift divinely given. I want to, in the final words of Charles Wesley's hymn, cast my crowns before thee, lost in wonder, love, and praise. Unlike the work of many contemporary artists for whom the gallery and museum are their primary contexts, the context for my work is ecclesiastical space. I thrive on creating site-specific, commissioned work. This way of working is contrary to the contemporary notion that doing commissioned work compromises an artist's autonomy and freedom. I think that within a given framework of parameters, unlimited possibility exists. Structure, I think, gives you the capacity to improvise. My artwork is empowered by community. It is by definition contextual. I am because we are. I have no problem with the notions of service and servanthood because I do not think it means the loss of autonomy. Rather, I view it as an opportunity to learn, to grow, and indeed to be transformed myself. When I receive a new commission, I begin by gathering data. I study the space, its sight lines, scale of parts, relative value relationships, its colors, intensities, and hues, and its surface textures. You people in the art department know what I'm speaking of. I meet the people who use the space, and most importantly, listen to their wishes and expectations. It is a two-way conversation. In this synagogue, notice the clear story, the chunk-like glass with abstract images in non-colored windows, neutral but textured surfaces, and a ceiling opened to the sky. There is centrally located color only in the Ark of the Covenant tapestry, which you will see in a moment. This space presents me with the physical data that I must consider during the design process. I am commissioned by this synagogue to create a huppah, a wedding canopy, interpreting the Song of Songs, literally in its lower tier and symbolically in its upper tier. It had to reside on this platform, which is 15 feet by 15 feet. It must be able to be erected within 1 hour by two people. It must be sturdy, and it must have a top or canopy. These structural requirements of this tent-like covering derive from Jewish tradition. Of course, I must thrash about while incubating a solution, and still the inner voice which judges so harshly. I am asked to dwell in the mystery of the unanswered questions. This requires radical trust in the process, not an impossible mindset for a person of faith. I believe that insights and a solution will come. As people of faith, you and I know that the great gift of life is that it forever reverberates with new possibilities. I am filled with gratitude for the insightful moments along the way. For me, they are grace-filled moments given as a gift in the collaborative effort of our own becoming. A recent commission taxed my imagination like no other. Its context was George Washington University Medical Center's meditation space. Outside the door of this small yet corporate-like space, adjacent to the emergency room, hangs a sign, "Meditation Room." Its sofa, three armchairs, coffee table, and large plate glass window looming over a busy DC intersection offers institutional respite to the Muslims, Christians, Jews, and others who enter it. The Women's Guild, desiring a more inspirational space, hired me as their instrument of change. However, hospital stipulations and DC regulations conspired continuously to derail our small increments of progress. Eventually, however, beautifully crafted monastic-like benches ringed the walls of this little space. Diffused lighting illuminated their 4-inch cushions covered in a fabric compatible with new carpet and painted walls. A prayer rug and kneeler were oriented towards a built-in niche for fresh flowers and holy books. Finally, I designed and fabricated this 9-foot by 3.5-foot work titled Passages for the room's one long, uninterrupted wall. This suggestive work, as metaphor, invites viewers to wander through its visual transitions. As in life, they are sometimes harsh, other times gentle, occasionally seamless, and always challenging. Passages embodies the notion of change, a given condition of life. Its design of visual contrasts evokes an internal conversation about passaging through life. The wash of warm yellow colors permeates the work with the constancy of sunlight. It infuses the piece with hope and reminds us of the faithfulness of divine presence. The large arc sweeping across the lower section suggests the comfort of a cradle to those meditating in the space. As I said earlier, the artist's way requires disciplined, rigorous work. Only in the doing of it will inspiration come. Next slide, please. Finally, a work will be born. The poet Robert Frost best sums up in the final stanza of Two Tramps in Mud Time the overarching point I have tried to make in this brief moment together. Let it be a reminder that particular paintings, poems, percussive accompaniment disclose meaning that is revelatory. He said, "But yield who will to their separation. My object in life is to unite my avocation and vocation, as two eyes make one in sight. Only where love and need are one, and the work is play for mortal stakes, is the deed ever really done for heaven and the future's sake." Thank you.